Have you news of my boy Jack? Not this tide. When do you think he'll come back? Not with this wind blowing and this tide. Has anyone else had word of him? Not this tide. From what he sunk will hardly swim. Not with this wind blowing and this tide. Oh dear, what comfort can I find? None this tide, nor any tide. Except he did not shame his kind, not even with that wind blowing and that tide. Then hold your head up all the more, this tide and every tide, because he was the son you bore and gave to that wind blowing and that tide. This was the poem that was written by the famous poet Rudyard Kipling soon after his only son, John, my boy Jack, went missing during the Battle of Loos in September of 1915. Kipling and his wife spent the rest of their lives trying to find out what had happened to their son, who was just 18, and they never did. They went to their graves, not knowing what had happened or where he was buried. And then in 1992, the Commonwealth War Graves Commission accepted evidence that a grave in St Mary's ADS Cemetery, not far from where John or Jack had fallen, was in fact his grave. And last week, during a trip to the Western Front, I visited his grave and also close to the point where he was last seen alive. Now, there's since been controversy and evidence submitted to the commission that this isn't in fact his grave, but the commission are still satisfied. So as far as we're concerned for this podcast, this is the final resting place of that young soldier. And Kipling never said that this poem was about his son, but it certainly portrays the words that he must have felt. And the podcast this week travelled to the Loos battlefield in the footsteps of another soldier who fell, not killed, but badly wounded, on the first day of that dreadful battle, the 25th of September, 1915. So why was I doing this? It's not the anniversary of the battle. I was doing this because I was contacted by this soldier's great-grandson, a lad called John Mann from Newcastle-upon-Tyne, and his great-grandfather was Private Thomas Mann of the 8th Battalion, the King's Own Scottish Borders. And it was their first day in action. They'd only arrived in France a few weeks earlier. They were part of the 15th Scottish Division, who'd only had 12 months training and service. And as I said, this was to be their first attack. They were actually in support of the main attack. They didn't go in the first wave. It was the 7th Battalion that they were following. And when they went over the top, their first job was to build communication trenches across no man's land between the old British front line and the German front line, which had been taken in the first wave. And we have a quote here from one of the soldiers that went over the top that day. He said, "I saw one man whose kilt had got caught on our wire as he passed through a gap. He did not attempt to tear it off, but carefully disentangling it, doubled up to his correct position in the line and went on." And that's evidence, therefore, of the training that they'd been through to ensure that every man knew exactly what his job was going to be that day. Now, the 15th Division moved on ahead. They moved across the Grenet Ridge, which was the position of the front line, but they found themselves ahead of the two divisions on their flanks as they went past the village of Loos, which gives its name to the battle, and then they approached Hill 70 in the distance beyond the village of Loos. They swarmed up the western slopes of Hill 70, and for once the Germans had not properly constructed their defences there. But all of their officers and NCOs were either killed or wounded in that fight for Hill 70. They got to the top, to the summit of Hill 70. They couldn't hold the position. By last light, the 46th Brigade, which they were with, had made contact with the 1st and the 47th Divisions on their flanks, but they had to fall back. And somewhere along the line that day, somewhere during the attack, Thomas Mann was badly wounded in his hand and arm, and at some stage his arm was amputated. So what we did on Saturday was to walk those battlefields with Thomas Mann's grandson, great-grandson, John Mann, and we started in the positions where they started on that day, and it was approximately 3.5 miles until we reached Hill 70. And this was an extremely emotional experience for John. So let's play a tape of exactly what happened. So we are now standing on the position where on the 25th of September, the King's Own Scottish Borderers, the 8th Battalion, advanced in support of the 7th Battalion in the direction of Lewes Village. On the right-hand side, we've got the Lens Road Redoubt, which is now the location of the Dud Corner Cemetery and the Lewes Memorial with all the names on. Beyond that, I can see the Double Crassier towering over the battlefield. And then across to the left on the ridge in front of me, 500 yards probably, would have been the German front line. Running parallel with the Lens Road Redoubt would have been the Lewes Road Redoubt, and this is where so many men of the 15th Scottish Division attacked successfully through these two redoubts. But then as they headed down into the dip into Lewes Village and up the other side of the hill to Hill 70, where there were so many casualties on the 25th and more on the 26th as they dealt with German counter-attacks. And I'm here with John Mann, and it was his great-grandfather Thomas that was with the 8th Battalion of the King's Own Scottish Borderers, and they were in support of the 7th Battalion, and we're going to walk the battlefield. It's a beautiful early June day. There's not a cloud in the sky. It's about 25 degrees, and we're going to walk in the footsteps of John's great-grandfather, who was one of the hundreds of the 8th Battalion of the King's Own Scottish Borderers that was wounded on that day on the 25th of September 1915, the first day of the Battle of Lewes. So we've now walked through what was no man's land, and we're now standing on the high ground between the two redoubts, the Lens Road Redoubt and the Lewes Road Redoubt. And this is where John's great-grandfather would have come through here, just to the left of this track. And their first job was to build communication trenches back across no man's land, so the support battalions and regiments that would come up wouldn't have to go through no man's land and be subject to German fire, which of course they were still within range of the German guns that were down in the valley towards Lewes Village over the top of the brow of the hill that we're approaching now. And of course on Hill 70, which was the next objective for the 15th Division. Hill 70, called Hill 70 because it's 70 metres above sea level. Can I ask you a question, John? How do you feel being here? What's brought you here in the first place?
After I started researching my family history, I found out my grandfather's name, which was Luce, as you know, his middle name.
So his middle name, he was called Luce, your grandfather. This is the son of Thomas Mann.
Yes.
And Thomas, as we know, has survived the Battle of Lewes, but he's been badly wounded, as we'll talk about in a minute. He's gone back after the war. He's had your grandfather, who's called?
Thomas Luce.
Called Mann. Thomas, and his middle name is called Luce,
yep.
Named after the Battle of Lewes, where his father has been badly wounded.
Yep.
And that's what brought you here. That's what made you start researching it in the first place.
Went.
And this is the first time that anyone from your family has been to these battlefields?
As far as I know.
Yeah. And how does it feel to be standing here? Can you describe it?
It's not really. It's strange, eh?
Following in your great... What about your grandfather and your dad? They've never been here.
They've never been here, no.
And we can see now in the distance as we go over the brow of the hill, the village of Lewes, which gives its the village that gives its name to this battlefield, and also to your grandfather's middle name. So, John, what I'm going to do is read to you some eyewitness accounts of what happened here at Hill 70, which is beyond the German front line in the Battle of Lewes. To our left, as we look back across the village of Lewes, we can see the Double Crassier, and in the distance the Dud Corner Cemetery and Lewes Memorial, which made out was one of the redoubts that was taken by the British on the first day of the battle, 25th of September 1915. And then your great-grandfather Thomas Mann has fought his way up here with the 8th Battalion, with his comrades from the 8th Battalion, the King's Own Scottish Borderers,
but we know from his service record that somewhere here, fighting up the western slopes of Hill 70, that he was wounded by a machine gun bullet to his left arm, was it? His left arm. And his service record shows that his left arm was fractured. He was also wounded in the hand. And we know that just over a year later, he was discharged from the British Army because he was no longer fit for active service. And we know from his pension record that at some stage along the way, in the evacuation process, his left arm was actually amputated. And you told me that one of your relatives remembered him having a patch over his eye.
Yeah. I don't know that for certain, but...
That's the rumour, isn't it?
Yeah.
But also that he had a hook where his left arm should have been. And I'm quoting now from this book called Lewes 1915 by the historian Nick Lloyd. And he's quoted the British official historian James Edmonds, and he says the fighting in Lewes had drawn together the mass of the 44th and the 46th Brigades. And the 46th Brigade is what the 8th King's Own Scottish Borderers were part of, the 46th Brigade. So that soon after 8 a.m. on a narrow front of about 600 yards near the eastern exit of the village, there was a great gathering of Scottish units, and the village is the village of Lewes that we've passed through just now. As they streamed out, thoroughly intermingled, and began the ascent of Hill 70 in a somewhat leisurely manner, they had had, in the words of Italian diarists, the appearance of a bank holiday crowd. So what that means is when they've got through the village, they've all got mixed up, the Scottish units have got mixed up, but as they come up the hill, they think that this is going to be an easy take. For the moment, there was a lull in the noise of the battle, and their advance appeared to be unopposed. So I'm now showing John some photos produced in Nick Lloyd's book, and there's an artist's impression of the hand-to-hand desperate fighting that took place here on the Lewes battlefield on that day. And there's also the famous photograph showing the gas that was released by the British with smoke clouds, which then subsequently blew back into the faces and caused lots of casualties within the BEF that day. And there's also photos in this book showing the wide expanse of No Man's Land and the Grenay Ridge that we've just come across, and also the village of Lewes itself. So then turning to another book from the Battlefield Europe Pen and Sword series. This book was written, it's called Lewes Hill 70, and is written by Andrew Rawson, who's written a number of books about the fighting on the Western Front. And within this book, we get another description of what happened here on Hill 70. The 46th Brigade met this fate. Seeing a number of men disappearing, the leading wave mistook them for Scots. They were, in fact, German artillerymen manhandling their guns on the rear, on the back of the exposed slope. So the Germans have got their guns just on the reverse slope here. With a cheer, Brigadier General Matheson's men ran forward to catch up. Waiting behind an uncut wire entanglement was a copy of the company of the 22nd Reserve Regiment, who had been roused from their billets by the noise of battle. So that's the German defenders. Their fire brought 46th Brigade charge to an abrupt halt. And it goes on to quote, when they crossed the crest of Hill 70, which is where we are sitting now in the bright sunshine, they found several machine guns in action and the line of King's Own Scottish Borderers on their left. So this is your great-grandfather Thomas. They joined up and advanced down the hill on the reverse side. There seemed to be some doubt just behind us, yeah, where we walked up. There seemed to be some doubt as to whether there was any of our troops in front. Suddenly they found a strong line of barbed wire concealed in the grass, and at the same time a heavy machine gun and rifle fire was opened upon them. They lay down and tried to find some cover, but there wasn't much cover here. And the book goes on to say that the advance of the 15th Division finished here, its force spent. Around 800 or 900 men lay pinned down in an arc. Attempts were made to get to grips with the Germans, and many tried to push forward in short rushes, but there was little hope, for each time they moved, the Germans opened a heavy crossfire. There was no other option but to dig in and wait for reinforcements. All across the bare slope, men desperately tried to scratch hollows in the ground. So they're trying to dig holes in the ground to find some safety
from the bullets that are flying around here on Hill 70 and just on the other side. So it's fairly certain that one of the casualties here on Hill 70 was your great-granddad, and we know that there was 139 men from his battalion that were killed that day, and I think we found that there's only four or five of them have a known grave, and the rest are remembered on the Lewes Memorial that we can see from here that we visited earlier on. Such was the chaos of the fighting here that if they have graves, we don't know where they are. At the foot of Hill 70 is the Lewes British Cemetery, and there are lots of unknown, known unto God, unknown graves in there, and some of those may be your great-granddad's mates, but we'll never know, of course. Sitting on top of Hill 70 now is a new memorial that was only opened here in 2019, I believe, just before COVID struck. And it's an obelisk, I suppose, isn't it? On it is inscribed the words Canada 1917 and a downward sword. And the reason that this beautiful memorial is here is that it wasn't until August 1917 that Hill 70 was finally taken, and it was taken by the Canadians in a brave fight here. And this memorial has been placed here to remember the sacrifice of those Canadian men that died on Hill 70. And you get fantastic views up here. Over to our left is the Double Crassier. Beyond the trees is the Dud Corner Cemetery, the Lewes Memorial. And then in the distance, we can see the Grenay Ridge, which is where we've come across. And how far did you say it was to here? 3.5 miles.
Just under three and a half miles.
So the 15th Scottish Division have made great progress here. It's ended in failure. They couldn't get any further than this, but they've got beyond the village of Lewes. But on either side, the two divisions on either side have been held up, which is why they're being hit by fire on both sides, because they're exposed. They've got further ahead. And I think I read in the battalion diary that eventually by the end of the day, they did manage to join up with the divisions on either side, but we know at great cost. And eventually the Battle of Lewes was seen as a failure, and the Commander-in-Chief, Sir John French, he lost his job over, he was replaced by Haig in December of 1915. So heads rolled, both on the battlefield and in the high command of the British Army. Lewes was one of the turning points of the war, because they learnt from their mistakes here. You know, they didn't have enough guns, they didn't have enough shells, and they increased firepower for future battles. It was an evolving situation. But he went back, didn't he? He went back home, your great-granddad,
yeah.
Thomas. He went back and had how many children?
A number
of children, one of which was your granddad.
Yep.
And it's your granddad that was able to tell us what he was like. And it was, as we said earlier, it was your granddad that was given the middle name Lewes after his father's actions here at Lewes in September of 1915. So going back to Nick Lloyd's book, he says that the renewed attempt to secure Hill 70 also failed. And by the morning of the 26th of September, the situation of the 15th Scottish Division was highly precarious. Units were mixed up, often leaderless, tired, short of ammunition, food and water, and were occupying only thin trenches below the crest. Many attempts were made by General Matheson, the GOC for the 46th Brigade, and other officers to check this tide, but all in vain, with the exception of a few of the 15th Division who somehow got mixed up in it, whom were at once obeyed the orders given to them. No attempt was made by any of these troops to stand. The men seemed incapable of grasping what was said to them. Ordered to get into the trenches and reform, the men merely stared vacantly into each other's faces and walked on. They appeared bereft of comprehension, and yet a sign of a German was to be seen. So they couldn't actually see the Germans that were firing on them.
So that was that. That was the end of the story as far as that particular soldier was concerned. And I know John was very emotional at the end of that walk on Saturday afternoon. It was beautiful, hot sunshine. We finished our walk, we went back to our hotel in Arras. And over the next couple of days, we toured the Western Front battlefields. We'd started in Ypres and we'd been to the Menin Gate. We'd visited Tynecot and we'd seen the beautiful roses, the red roses in full bloom at Tynecot. And we'd then gone down to the Somme and visited the Loch Na Garr crater. And it was a very special weekend at the Loch Na Garr crater because it was their working weekend and the first time that Richard Dunning, the owner, had been able to organise such a weekend since before the pandemic. And therefore, during that time, the crater had looked a bit dishevelled, really. It had become overgrown. The moss within the crater itself was almost out of control. The bush that surrounded it, or rather the hedge that surrounded it, was taller than it should be. So Richard, through the Loch Na Garr Crater Association, had recruited 40 volunteers that went over to the Somme and paid their own way. They paid their own travel costs. They paid their own accommodation costs and everything else that goes with it. And over the period of the bank holiday weekend, they got the crater looking absolutely splendid again and ready for the annual service, which will be held on the 1st of July, of course, the anniversary of the first day of the Battle of the Somme. So while we were there, we talked to Richard Dunning and recorded a chat with Richard, which is coming up now. And we also spoke to one of the volunteers that had been working in the heat there, Sam Gascoigne, and he told us what it was actually like to go down into the crater and look up. We're so used to standing on the lip of the crater and looking down. What was it like to be down in the crater itself, just as so many of those soldiers found themselves on that dreadful first day in July 1916? So have a listen to this interview, and I'll see you on the other side. So I'm now standing at the Loch Na Garr crater, which we featured in a previous podcast when we went and interviewed Richard Dunning, the owner of Loch Na Garr crater, at his home. And we're now actually standing at the crater where I was here a few weeks ago, and the crater has undergone a complete transformation from 40 volunteers, you said, over the last few days. What have they been doing, Richard?
I think the main thing is to try and get into the crater and actually get the undergrowth. Up here it looked like thick bushes. When you're down there, they were starting to be small trees. I mean, it's 2 years, obviously, with COVID that we haven't been able to do. So this weekend, our working weekend, and 40-odd, probably more, because several sort of French came and helped. Amazing. And in sort of 75 degrees, 80 degrees of heat, they were cutting. And not only that, because everything that has to be cut then has to be cleared from the crater, because within a week it all goes brown and looks horrible. So clearing it up, it has been extraordinary to see the amount of dedication from these amazing people. We've cut the if you like, the surface of it, that's all trimmed and everything. The hedges is looking good. And as Terry said, within 2 days, it has transformed it. So deeply, deeply impressed with everybody. And it looks great. The good thing, when it is trimmed, it looks bigger. It looks its true size, because it is, unless you get someone down there, it's there. But no, it's just looking amazing. And we had 2-3 days of good weather, bit of rain this morning, but it doesn't matter. We're nearly there, and we'll give it another half a day. It's all been prepared for July the 1st for the ceremony, obviously, but it is looking better. It looked as bad on Wednesday, Thursday that it's ever done for years.
First arrived,
yeah, because it took 10, when I bought it, it took 10 years to get it under control, the stuff that was growing down there. But now, with all that is amazing, people work for hours and hours doing, I mean, ever so hard, not only strimming on a crumbling 45 degree chalk slope as well, with rabbit holes.
No accidents from anyone? No one got hurt?
No one at all. We do have a safety officer, and we take it very seriously, and everybody has equipment and everything, but they're all sensible. And it has just been as put in my message this morning to people, it's inspiring to see what people can do off their own back. They all pay for themselves, and they turn up incredible.
So these people that have come along are members of the Loch Na Garr Crater Association that have come along and done this. 40 people, plus local villagers, and they've all paid for their own way and their own accommodation, haven't they? Come over here, and they've done this for the love of the Somme, to remember the men from all nations that died here and on the Western Front. And they've also come here because you've inspired them, I think, Richard, to come and do this, you know, with buying and maintaining this crater. Tell us again what this means to you.
Well, I always think that it It is a symbol of the of I mean, here is, it's the bloodiest square mile on the Western Front. I think it actually is, because no one's come and said no. So here there were more men killed in a small space, and maybe in 30 minutes or whatever. The trauma that happened all around here, and obviously right the way up the front, I mean, it's not even the Somme, it's all the battles, and arguably the whole war. This is a symbol as a wound that is in every single family of those who suffered and those who fell. So in a way, when people come, and we've had people come from Australia, from Belgium, from all over, Netherlands,
Germany.
Germans, some dear friends who've been working here from Germany, they come over. But it is, you know, we are stewards of it for a blink of an eye, really. But if we can hand it over to the next generation so that they come, if anybody hasn't seen it, when you look into it and you realise the force and violence of what was then modern industrial warfare, of the power of that explosion, you know, pumping billions of pounds of chalk a mile into the sky, and the young men in the trenches 100 yards away, and then of course they had to get up. The Germans then, as we know, were ready for them, and they're very good at getting their guns up. And Britain changed.
Changed that day, didn't it? On that day.
Arguably in an hour, the first hour, the flower of Edwardian youth. And we've never recovered. And in a way, the crater with this wound, it represents
a symbol
in for all countries, because every country that goes into war, the families suffer, and the families and the descendants of that. So in a way, that's what this place draws people. I've been talking to a lot of visitors the last couple of days. Every single person turns out to be a good, nice, sensible, very, very nice person with a story. They've all got why they come.
They all do. We found that, yeah. And it's incredible, as we stand here today, just on the lip of the crater, behind us is the village of La Boisselle, which was the objective for the 34th Division on that day. And we're looking out. When we arrived here an hour ago, there was a terrible thunderstorm, wasn't it? The thunder sounded like artillery when we were here earlier. And we're looking out into the Tara Usna Hills, and that's where those men for the Northumberland Fusiliers, the Tyneside Scots and Irish, they made their way across those. And of course, a lot of them didn't even get to the front line, did they? And those that did, we're looking down into the crater, and that's their burial ground, isn't it, for many of those guys?
Yeah. What we've tried to do is to open up the 270 degree panorama,
yes.
Right the way around. And of course, on the left is where the Grimsby Chums and the Royal Scots or whatever, they suffered terribly there, and even flamethrowers. I mean, it was a killing ground, the carnage. But it's just so peaceful now, and to be here with just a few people is brilliant. You can sense it. And when I come over, I've just shared this with you, but I actually talk to the crater, because I feel there's a connection here. And I think the lads somewhere or there, they would be pleased at this, the people that have come to this place, and people like you, Terry, who are doing so much to, you know, to bring it, keep it in the forefront of people's minds as well.
I think, like we said when we met the other week, is that the whole point in doing these podcasts and doing this actually on the ground for the first time is to try and inspire people to come out here. And hopefully, here comes one of the volunteers now. Like, here comes Sam carrying some more debris. And I know Sam's been here working in the heat. It's to try and inspire people to come here, isn't it, and see the crater and meet the people here, because you're never here alone. There's always people here with you, isn't there? And you come quite a lot, don't you? You're still getting here a lot.
Yeah, I mean, obviously COVID dropped a spanner in the works and everything, and we got over as much as we could, you know. But I always reckon, particularly for the scores are now starting to come, the French scores are coming quite a lot. But when you go and look into the lip from the first time, something happens, and an understanding of what the reality of war, you know, because numbers and things don't mean, but when you think about the force and awesome sort of force of that explosion against, you know, frail young young men, and we always include the women, the nurses, a mile or two behind has suffered as well. And actually, it brings it home, and I always think, you look into the crater for the first time, you are never quite the same again, because now there's other sites, of course, that are as there, but, and I'm biased, I mean, just take everything I say, but I think it serves its purpose, you know.
I think so. That's great. I'm going to have a wander around and see if we can have a word with one or two of these volunteers and see what they've been going on. But great to see you again, Richard.
Okay, good to see you, Terry.
Thanks a lot. And we'll see you again soon.
We'll speak soon, yeah.
So I'm still at Loch Nagar Crater, haven't moved. Richard has moved on. And I'm stood here with Sam Gascoigne, who's been coming to the Somme for many years, 15, 20 years probably, isn't it? And Sam has been one of the working group and a member of the foundation, the association. So Sam's been here since, I think, Thursday. What have you been doing, Sam?
So I've joined about 40 other volunteers, effectively, to just tidy up the whole site. It's been a few years since a working party has taken place here because of COVID, obviously. And this is my first event, and I've just been trimming hedges and strimming inside the crater and then raking up all the debris and effectively just trying to generally tidy up the whole site and make it presentable for the next generation of visitors who come here.
I think what Richard said was that he wanted it to be smartened up. To me, it looks like it's had a good haircut since I was here a few weeks ago. And Richard wanted it to be presentable for the 1st of July when he'll hold his annual event here. When you get down there, I've never been down there. What's it like actually down in the crater, Sam? What does it feel like?
It's a little bit eerie because effectively it is a mass grave. It looks a lot bigger when you're down in the crater and you look up, and you do get another perspective of just what an immense site this is, and the explosion that took place here. You can't really put it into words. You just feel overwhelmed by it almost.
And as we're speaking, it looks like abseiling going on down there. There's from either side of the crater, two of the volunteers have let go of a rope, and they're using that. What they're using that for? Talk us what they're doing, sir.
So, having strimmed the whole of the inside of the crater, the debris has then all been raked down into the bottom, into the well. That is now all being collected into bags, and these ropes that you see then serve as pulleys to lift the debris back out of the crater, and then they take it away to an area at the back of La Boiselle village where it's going to be burnt.
There was a 12-year-old lad doing this yesterday, wasn't there? What was he up to?
Yeah, he was strimming. There's been a number of younger people, both British and French, who've been here helping. And, you know, they've all been given jobs and kept very, very busy. It was exceptionally hot yesterday in the crater because you don't get the breeze down there. You're sheltered from it. But they've all done a magnificent job. And as you can see, Terry, it just looks so much better now than it did even a few days ago.
Yeah. And the 40 people, I saw you had a bit of a, was it last night, you had a bit of a party, barbecue. Did you know any of those people then, before you came along and got involved in the team?
Didn't know anybody. But having come out here in September last year, I noticed that the crater wasn't quite in the state of repair that you would normally see it in, which, you know, there were good reasons for that. And I spoke to David and Julie at number 56 where I was staying and just said, if there's anything I can do to help, let me know. And they provided details of the working party and bank holiday weekend. What could be better than a few days on the Somme?
Well, that's fantastic work. It really is. It's truly inspiring to see this, actually, to see what it means to so many people. So thanks very much for that, Sam. And no doubt you'll be here next year.
Hope so, yes. Right, back to work.
And back to work, Sam went, and we stood there and watched him work before we moved on. And from Loch Nagar Crater, we made the short journey to Mametz Wood, where the Welsh Division fought for over five terrible days against the Prussian Guards in July of 1916, during the second week of the battle. And without going into detail of what happened, that's a story for another day, we walked across a field shortly after the sun had come out, after a terrible thunderstorm which lasted about 10 or 15 minutes. It was incredible to see. At the time of the thunderstorm, we were sitting in the car at a place called Poisier, where the Australians had fought. and the lightning crashed across the sky, followed by crashes of thunder. And you could just imagine what it must have been like to have been there in 1916, but of course without the fear and jeopardy. But back to this field near Mametz Wood, we walked across it. It was quite muddy, and then we put our foot into a puddle, and it was almost impossible to drag your foot out of it again. And immediately we thought back to the conditions in the latter stages of the Battle of the Somme in October and November of 1916, and wondered what it must have been like for those lads having to fight the conditions themselves, the muddy conditions, before they could even think about fighting the enemy. And there we were, trampling across this field, and it really did make you think about those soldiers of days gone by. And then later on that evening, we returned to our hotel in the centre of Arras, and we went down into the Grand Place in Arras on the Saturday night and saw an incredible sight, really, a sight that we took for granted before the COVID pandemic. The square and the surrounding streets were absolutely packed, not with British tourists, but with locals out enjoying the open-air restaurants and cafes. And we sat there and had a lovely meal, a lovely French meal, and just watched the people go by and reflected upon everything that we'd seen over the last couple of days. And going back a couple of days earlier than that, the first night that I met John, I actually met him in the city of Ypres. And we had a quick tour around Ypres. And then we attended the last post ceremony. And I went to the ceremony just a few weeks ago, and there was only probably about 60 or 70 people there, something like that. The ceremony was over in just a few minutes. There was hardly any people that were laying wreaths. But on this occasion, it was so different. It was absolutely packed. During the COVID days, the association, the Last Post Association, had marked places on the ground 2 metres apart where just 200 people were allowed to stand. Those marks are still there, but there must have been, I don't know, a couple of thousand people there on Saturday night. There was a long stream of people walking down the steps from one side, up the steps on the other side, and laying their wreaths. And there must have been 40 or 50 bikers that were in town. And it made a spectacular sight seeing all their bikes parked up by the side of the gates. And several of them also laid wreaths at the memorial. There were still no coaches there, though, which I was a bit surprised about. I think possibly because it was the D-Day weekend. Most of the coach tours had perhaps gone to Normandy. But it really was wonderful to see mainly locals, lots of families, local families. But then I heard some English voices and got chatting to one family, and they were coming back from a family holiday during the half-term holidays. I think they'd been down to Paris or somewhere like that, maybe further south. And the couple had four children, three girls and a boy. And one of the girls in particular was very interested in history. So they'd made the detour to come to Ypres and visit the Meningate ceremony, and you could see it meant a lot to them, which was absolutely wonderful to see families returning to the battlefields, and in particular to the fantastic Last Post ceremony, which has been held right the way through the pandemic. But it really did feel, both in Arras, on the Somme, and in Ypres, that life had returned to normal. And all I can do really is encourage people to return to the battlefield yourselves should you get the opportunity, either to go on your own with a small tour like I do, or on the larger tours with companies like Ledger Tours. There are so many options that are open to us these days. There really is no excuse. And then when we were at Tietvelle, we went to Tietvelle on the Sunday down on the Somme, and there wasn't that many people there, and we found ourselves alone in front of the memorial, which the last piece of scaffolding is just about to be removed. And the clearing up operation will then begin, and the memorial will be back to its original condition, and visitors will be able to go and stand underneath the 16 piers again and stare in amazement at the 72,000 names of the missing on the Tietvelle memorial. But while we were there, we were approached by a French television crew, and they wanted to do an interview, which we did. And the question that they wanted to ask was, why aren't British visitors returning to France and to the battlefields? Which I was a bit surprised by, because, as I'd said, we'd seen quite a lot of British visitors on the Western Front over the few days. And one of the museums down in Piranha told them that they're still only getting half the visitors that they got before the pandemic. And they wondered what the reasons were for that. And I explained to the camera crew that numbers are gradually returning to the battlefields. But the biggest issue, I think, is still been the recovery from COVID and people getting the confidence to return, not just to the battlefields, but to other parts of Europe and beyond as well. But those numbers are coming back, and I explained to them how there'd been so much interest from people in the UK wanting to travel back to the battlefields and beyond. And it's not just going to the battlefields to see the memorials. It's also to do what we've done and experience the wonderful French and Belgian hospitality and get back to enjoying that. They seemed surprised, but very happy that I'd given them that feedback. And only when the recording finished, of course, did I think, always think of these things as you walk away. And I thought, well, obviously the cost of living increase that we've seen in Britain and throughout Europe will also be a factor. Because if you drive down yourself, it's going to cost a lot more money than it would have done just a few months ago before the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So there's all those factors. And as I say, I forgot to even mention that. But I think what I was trying to do was pass on a very positive message from the UK to France that we do want to return to that wonderful country. And one other thing that we did during our weekend on the Western Front, it was only 4 days, but it seemed like a lot longer because we managed to cram so much in. We visited a place in Poppering, behind the British lines, about 8 miles from Ypres. And we visited the wonderful Talbot House, which was established in 1915 by a man called Tubby Clayton. And it became a refuge for British soldiers coming out of the line or moving up to the line throughout the First World War on the way to the terrible Ypres battlefields. And we recorded a podcast there with Simon, who is the manager of Talbot House. And that will be our next podcast coming up next week. And I do recommend you tune in for that, because Simon is a lively character, full of enthusiasm, a man who lives in Poppering, so many stories to tell. And again, he's trying to encourage people to come and visit Talbot House in Poppering. So that will be next week. So it just remains for me, Terry Wenham, to thank you once again for tuning in to this 12th episode of Tales from the Battlefields. I'm really grateful for feedback that people have been sending me, you know, on Facebook or Twitter or emails and all the rest of it. It really does help. And what really helps is the reviews that you leave on Apple Podcasts, because I understand the way it works is the more reviews we get on there, the more distribution it gets through Apple and other avenues. I'm slowly getting to understand how all this works. So, yes, thank you very much for tuning in. And as usual, I'd like to pay tribute to the men of the King's Own Scottish Borderers that died on the 25th of September 1915 on the first day of the Battle of the Loos on the Grenay Ridge and at Hill 70, and also Rudyard Kipling's son, John Jack Kipling.